Our subject today is television, and for a chat with a man whose talents have been brightening the TV tube for more than 20 years, we've taken our microphones out to the beautiful Drury Lane Theater, where the current production is the Neil Simon comedy hit Plaza Suite. And the current Drury Lane star is our guest. He's a fine actor, a brilliant writer, and a great comedian. Sid Caesar, welcome to Those Were the Days.
Thank you very much.
I can recall a United Nations sketch you did once on the old Show of Shows program, and every one of your talents were used. I'm sure you probably had a good hand in writing it, Sid. And in that sketch, you played not one but four foreign dignitaries in a luncheonette. You played the proprietor, the jukebox, the cash register, a sizzling grill, and a wisecracking waitress. Can you recall that sketch?
Well, I don't think you said in the right order or the right thing, but it's something out of order. In fact, that was one of the sketches I did in my first Broadway show. It was called Make My Manhattan. And, yes, I did a sketch with the late David Burns, who was a great, great comedian himself. And I did, I think, an Arabian and an Englishman, I think, and a Frenchman and a Russian.
And the cash register,
too. And I played the cash register. Yeah. Well, that was all in the same show.
These fantastic imitations, if they would be that, or recreations of machinery.
Objects.
Yeah, inanimate object. How did you ever decide to do something like that? What gave you the idea to
Well,
to
I always thought
something?
That, like I have a story that I used to do about a white wall tire, and he comes off, you know, the factory, and he's the left white wall tire in the rear, and boy, he goes everywhere. He's on a limousine, and he travels everywhere. And his friend becomes the right rear tire, and they become great friends, and they go to only the best places. And he's always washed every day, and he's taken very good care of. He's never backed into a curb or anything. And all of a sudden, a little while goes by, and something changes in his life, you know. And he's starting to go on farther trips, and he's getting heavy with a lot of luggage, and he's getting his friend that's very hot, and they're on a hot road, and his friend, the right rear tire, is starting to go. And he said, gee, don't go. I mean, just hold on. Once we get over this hill, we'll be okay. And his friend goes, you know, and sees him, and they take him up and throw him on the side of the road and put on the spare. Now, he doesn't even know the spare. And he says, you don't know what it was like, you know, boy, in the old days when we used to have good times, and now we have to do this. I don't know what we're doing. We carry a lot of people, and a lot of people up to mountains and things. I don't know what we're doing. And all of a sudden, he starts to go. And then he does go, and they throw him on the side of the road. And then some kids come along, they pick him up, and they roll him along, and they tie him up to a tree, and he becomes a swing. So it has a happy ending. So it's just, you know, a little thing like that, just to make a story out, because you can take anything that's inanimate. There are atoms in it. They're moving. Mm-hmm. No one knows what kind of life there is in the table or in that microphone or whatever it is. So that was my imagination, even as a child. I always used to say, you know, I wonder what the clock is thinking about right now. If it can think, or if it can't think, or what it is.
You just wondered what something could think when they couldn't express themselves, or it couldn't express itself.
That's
I remember
right.
a routine you did once about a little baby.
That's right, what the baby thought.
Yeah, it's great. It's good stuff, good stuff. You got your start, you were playing the saxophone, and you were playing with a few big-name bands, weren't you?
Yes, I was 16. I was playing with Claude Thornhill, Charlie Spivak, Shep Fields.
And then?
And then I went to the Coast Guard.
And someone saw you in the Coast Guard when you were doing you were in the Coast Guard show, I think, weren't you?
Well, I was in the Coast Guard show only because of Vernon Duke. I happened to be stationed with him. And he was commissioned along with Howard Dietz, to write the Coast Guard, the official Coast Guard show. And I was in a band with Vernon Duke. Not an official band. It was a band that we got some fellas together on a bass, and we just started it. And when he wrote this, I used to kid around in between the sets. And I don't know, from nowhere, I mean, from watching these pictures, you know, especially the airplane number, which came out. Mm-hmm. That was originally peacetime airplane pictures and then wartime airplane pictures.
Uh-huh.
And then I met Max Liebman down in at Palm Beach. And he was directing the show. And we rewrote it and just made it the airplane number.
Uh-huh.
And from there, I went around the country, and they saw me. They wanted me in the picture. And that's how I got my break right there.
That was the big thing. But actually, that was probably the only memorable scene in the movie. We're talking about the film Tires and Spars.
That's right.
And that was the Coast Guard show was called Tires and
That's
Spars,
right.
too. For some of our younger listeners who hadn't had the chance yet to see Tires and Spars, and I don't think it's been on television.
Oh, yes.
Has it been around?
Yes.
Oh, great. We'll have to look for it again. But what was that scene when you were in the... on board a ship, weren't you?
I was on board a ship, uh-huh. And they said, let's go, you know, let's see a movie tonight, you know, mm-hmm. on the ship. I said, I saw this one, and I said, this is what it's all about. And so I said, and I did the movie for them.
Uh-huh. You recreated
I recreated the sound and the whole thing.
Boy, that was really fun.
It was fun. It almost wasn't in the picture, because it ran 8.5 minutes. But after the preview, they left mm-hmm. it in.
Oh, they did leave it in.
Oh, yeah.
Did you kind of go into a Hollywood limbo for a little while after that picture was released? Then, as far as other pictures were concerned, before
no,
they
I did another
found
picture.
You on
the... Did well, you? I was still in uh-huh. Coast Guard when I made that uh-huh. picture.
Oh, you were in the Coast Guard at the time you made the
yeah,
film?
Yeah, I made $6 a day. That was my
for
salary.
For the film.
That was
uh-huh.
it. I made $6 a day, and that was the for the film.
Mm-hmm.
Then when I got out of the Coast Guard, they put me in another picture, which I didn't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran away from Hollywood, and I went to the Copacabana, which I had never been in I had never been in my club as a guest, let alone mm-hmm. as a performer. And I had four numbers, and that was it. My entire repertoire.
The whole bit right there.
Right.
When did Max Liebman and you meet?
Down in Palm Beach.
And
he directed Tires and Spars.
He directed Tires and Spars?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. I wasn't aware that he had directed that. And then when he was forming the idea for the television thing back in about 49, wasn't it?
Well, in 49. See, mm-hmm. Make My Manhattan, they were having trouble with the show, and they wanted some help with the writing, so I said, okay, I'll write, but I want Max to be in it. So I got Max in to help with the sketches, and from there, Max used to have his thing up at Tenements.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said they wanted to do a show, the Admiral Broadway Review, and he wanted me in it. So I said, fine. And I went right from Make My Man Manhattan into the Admiral Broadway Review, which went right into Show of Shows, which went right into Caesar's Hour, which went right into all the other shows.
Everything you've done. Was that the first exposure you had had on television at that time, the Admiral Broadway Review? Had you done anything before that at all?
Oh, I did one thing in 1946, I think, just a small little thing on Hollywood. Just experimenting with it.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that was the first time you had met Imogene Coca.
I met Imogene, yes, the first time we got together for the show, or for the Admiral Broadway Review.
Oh.
And as soon as we hit it off very well.
Now, had you, you hadn't worked exactly as a team throughout the whole thing. You were teamed up for many sketches on the show, but you each did single comedy sketches, too. Because I can remember many things that you had
done. She did a single, and I did a single.
Yeah.
An hour and a half show, you can't be together all the time.
And you just...
You've got to let go once in a while. Just take a breath.
If only for that. Now, you wrote quite a bit of that material.
Yes, I did.
And some of your companions in the writing end of the television were some people who have become pretty well known since then, too. Yeah. Mel Brooks and Neil Simon, who wrote the play that you're starring in out here at the Drury Lane Theater. I read a story one time that said that Mel Brooks was describing the writer's conference for the Show of Shows. And he said that you and he and a couple of the other writers, I guess Carl Reiner and Howie Morris were writing some of these things.
No, Howie never wrote.
Howie did. Carl did.
Carl helped it a little in writing.
At any rate, you got together and you would start kicking an idea around, and before long everybody would be on the floor laughing about one of these things, and then eventually it worked its way into a sketch for the show.
Sometimes it worked like that, yes.
Is it more serious business than that?
That's much more serious than that, because when you walk in there Monday morning, you have no idea what you're going to do. So you're actually in the dark, and you have to start.
Out of the 90 minutes from the Show of Shows, about how much of that time was devoted to comedy?
I would say about 65-70%.
And you knocked out a complete review every week.
That was live with no cue cards, no teleprompters, no nothing.
How were you able to maintain the quality? Because certainly did.
You have to remember, I would say we had a good average. Every show wasn't great. Some shows were much better than other shows. Some shows were average. And some shows just didn't come off. But we had a pretty good batting average. But we took a lot of pain and a lot of time to do these things. And that's, my whole life was that. I mean, I spent 17, 18, 20 hours a day writing, because when we came in on Monday morning, the back of the show had to be broken, writing-wise, by Wednesday, Wednesday afternoon. That had to be it, because it had to be up on its feet Thursday morning. So Wednesday it had to be broken by writing, and Thursday the whole show had to be broken, up on its feet and blocked. Because Friday was, we had the engineering staff would come in and they'd see the show, get a look at it. Just the key men, the top cameraman, the top the audio man, all the props and everything else. And the scenic men would come in, and the costume men would come in, and they'd get a look at what was going to be. Because that all had to be put together in the space of 48 hours, because Saturday was the show.
And there was no turning back, no videotape at that time.
No, if you made a mistake, that was it.
Did you think it was better videotape?
Well, right now you don't expect to see any mistakes, because they can do it over again. But that time, it was more or less like when you watch football. You don't know if the guy's going to catch the pass, or if he's going to make the run, or if there's a penalty, or if there's this, or if there's that. You're looking at it, something that's really going on. That's what television is all about, until it became a dopey box, And now it's a pablum, They dish it out a little bit at a time.
Do you think television was better 18 or 20 years ago than
much
today?
Much better, yes. I think it was much better, because today it doesn't make any difference what program. You can pick any program up in the middle or the end or in the beginning. Doesn't matter. It's the same.
Is it a lack of creativity, or is it because things cost too much?
No, it was a lack of... They destroyed themselves because of their own economics and their own greed and their own just wine power. And they destroyed themselves. Television today is not one-tenth, one-millionth of what it used to be. It has no following whatsoever. I don't think many people on the... And I'm not being bitter in any case. I mean, there are good shows on the air. I'm not saying... I'm not putting all television down. But most of television is... I don't watch too much of it. I watch a lot of documentaries. I watch a lot of news. I watch a lot of sports. There are a few things coming on. I watch a lot of the things that are coming out of England, the BBC. Masterpiece Theatre had all that series, Forsyth. I think it was very, very good. The Churchills, and then this thing that I think CBS has a series now, Henry VIII.
Henry VIII, yeah.
Now that, to me, is, yes, that's something that's worthwhile. Now that's That's at least
but
quality.
I don't see any good original comedy on television. Say original comedy,
it.
Like this
well,
Sid Caesar style.
Well, they've killed it. It's too much. They don't want it because, you see, if you give a person a steak, that's meat. And meat is expensive. Mm. See? And you have to nurse the steer as it's coming along, and you've got to take care of it, you know. But if you just want a plastic lamb chop, we could give you that all the time. It, you know, looks like a lamb chop, but it's really dog food. You know, chopped up and nice and little cake, and it's, don't have to put it in a can no more. Just put it in cellophane, and just rip it with your finger, and that's it. You got it. And that's the whole thing. That's what they've done. They've packaged it, put it in a can, and that's it. It's an old saying now. It's out in Hollywood. You want it good, or do you want it Tuesday? That's it.
Yeah, but you gave it to him good, and you gave it to him Saturday.
Well, we gave it to him the best we can, and we had to give it to him Saturday, but we gave him the best we can. I mean, we actually went, you know, turned ourselves upside down and inside out to give it to him. But there isn't that much in it anymore because people say, so what? Doesn't make any it's who you follow and what's your time slot, and who's your backer and who's your sponsor, and that's it. And forget everything, and how much is it? And how many weeks have we got, and how much is that, and how much is this? And that's it. And the agency comes in and says, well, that we take our cut and goodbye.
What's to become of television then?
I don't
what
care.
Do you think?
I really don't care.
You don't? Do you think that, do you think that if a Max Liebman were to try to produce a show of shows today, let's not discuss the dollars and cents end of it. Do you think that it could live today? Do you think it would go? You think the public would be there waiting for Sid Caesar and Imogene Coca and the others?
I really don't know. I couldn't tell you. I mean, the mood of the American people now is so polarized, I couldn't give you an answer on that. I wouldn't know.
I think I could give you an answer. I think that they would be there.
I would hope so.
I think they'd be there waiting for some good original comedy.
Well, this is the whole thing. See, original, there is no such a thing as original. It's always taken from something and put with something else, and then you make a new mixture. And this is what's, as you say, is I think is lacking. They're making attempts at it. I mean, there are some good attempts being made. But as I said before, they won't let it live. They can't let it live. Because it's if you put something good on, what are the other stuff going to look like? If they got a laugh machine going all the time with some of these shows, but at some, with all these shows, if you have a laugh machine going, I take that back, not with all of them. There are some shows that don't have a laugh track, and more power to them. Let the audience make up their mind if they're going to laugh or not. So I say that, yes, give it a chance to be, but you can't breathe. They won't let you breathe. Because they want a surefire thing, immediately sold, pre-sold, paid for, $2.5 million up front. And if you do that, then it's got to be solid, and you sign this kind of new. By the time the lawyers get through, you have no time to write a show because you're too busy signing papers and releases and signs and more clauses. And you must not, you cannot stand. You must stand here, salute, and stand at attention in my head and watch your fingernails, or else you don't.
All right, so now we know what you think about television today. What are you doing about comedy today?
Well, what can I do? What can I do about comedy?
I read in the program at the Drury Lane Theater here that says that you're interested in fostering good comedy again, I want to know what you're doing about it.
Well, what we're going to do, we're going to
you're the right guy to do it.
Yes, we're going to try and in fact, we have several offers now to syndicate the old shows and Caesar's Hour.
You mean the kinescopes, tapes, or what have you?
No, there were no tapes, there were just kinescopes.
No.
And we were in the process of making these deals. And I think if the people want to see it, they can see the originals.
The 90-minute show of shows and the
60-minute
Caesar's Hour?
Don't have to be 60 minutes. You can cut them down to half hours.
Would you like to see that though? Would you like to see them chop up a 90-minute show of shows?
There was a lot of production numbers there. Right. They went on for 18 courses that I thought could be cut down to about two.
But what would you feel about your Well, I suppose that you wouldn't care if they cut the production numbers, but as long as they left
the comedy. Well, if you want to leave the production numbers in, it's all right with me. If you want to cut out the comedy, I think it would be then you'd have a nice dance. You want to see a nice dance for 90 minutes? And a jump and a twirl.
Some of the greatest comedy things that you've ever done were in the form of satire.
I always think satire.
Parodies, everything is satire, sure. The takeoffs on the movies. What was the takeoff that you and Imogene did on From Here to Eternity? It was called...
From Here to... what was it?
Obscurity.
From Here to Obscurity. Who was sued on that? Columbia Pictures sued us. They lost.
They lost.
They lost. Lost the case. Columbia Pictures lost.
Right into the
LOST. Lost case. CBS.
Why did they sue you? What was it? Because
we took their idea. And I said, look, you're going to make a lot of money by us doing satire. Mm. And they said, no. And they made a lot of money. And they lost the case. Lost. LOST. Lost the case.
Now, what was the name of the... I can't think of the name of the character. He was kind of a Nazi professor that you used to do. He was...
No, he wasn't
whole,
Nazi.
Well, he was...
No, he was kidding around.
Ludwig.
Ludwig von Know-It-All.
Von Know-It-All. Oh, some of those characters that you had were great. Somerset Winterset.
I did a take off of Somerset Maugham. We used to sit there, and he would take... It was a half-hour show, and 23 minutes of it was him explaining the show that was coming up, and I said, I got to do a takeoff for this guy, because he's fair game.
And then there was another character that, I guess you used your saxophone quite a bit on the
cool
show.
Oh, Cool Seas, yeah.
Cool Seas, yeah. That was a parody.
Progress Hornsby.
Progress Hornsby. And then the three fellas, the singing group that you and...
The Haircuts.
The Haircuts.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any. But you were way ahead of... I mean, they didn't have haircuts. They had long
hair. No, we had long hair with them, but we didn't know. We just, we said, well, let's do something crazy.
That would stand up well today.
What, the Haircuts? That's a mild thing.
No, well, I mean, all of this sort of thing. Well, how did you develop these dialects?
Well,
you don't really speak these languages,
no,
do you?
No, I don't. Let's say my father had a restaurant in Yonkers, New York. And I used to listen to all these men that would come in, and would, be from every ethnic group, German, Italian, or French, whatever, Polish, Russian. And I would listen to them, and I'd just pick it up.
And that was your home base, was your training ground. You didn't think at that point that you would be using these
dialects. No, I had no idea.
But you did a great job with them.
Well, lucky.
And you still do. We really enjoyed your performance in
Thank
Plaza
you very
Suite
much.
Here.
Thank you.
The Sid Caesar we know and love is right on stage, close as you can be.
Well, that's... there again, is contact with an audience.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean. Because when I did my shows, there was always a live audience. If something didn't go, it didn't go. And there were different audiences. And... Again, you have that contact with the audience, and you feel them, and you know if something is going, if something is not going. And if you see it going, you play it. And if it's not going, you don't land too much. You go through it a little bit, which gives you a different pacing for each show. Again, you're seeing it live. Something can go wrong. Somebody can forget a line, or somebody can forget a prop, or something's out of place. Even this show that you saw, the opening act, there was a chair out of place, and I had to get it back into place, and she did. But nobody knew about it, but she did.
Did you have that kind of freedom when you were doing the show of shows or Caesar's Hours? Were you?
There was a lot of stuff. When you're doing it live, nothing is perfect. You can't do it. Mm-hmm. It's that slick, and something goes wrong, she went to a place, or I went to a place that wasn't right, or a camera went out, and all of a sudden, instead of having four cameras, you had three, and sometimes two cameras went out, and you only had two. You had to change your blocking right there. So that was it. Right on the program.
Yeah. What about the continuity of the sketch, though? If you felt that it wasn't going over as well as you had hoped in the other earlier sessions, did you ever modify that? Did you ever change it?
Oh, sure. And there was also the time element. You had a lot of factors going. had about a lot of elements. Aside from the mechanical, you had the if you thought a sketch was going to go very well or a monologue was going to go very well, you'd say, okay, I'll hurry this up. You know, we'll shoot through this a little bit because it's not going too well. So, all right, we'll hurry through this because I think the next one may be it, and we can take our time on that. So what we pick up, we may pick up, say, 20, 30 seconds, which is an awful lot. You'd be surprised what it takes to pick it up in production or anything like that. But you have 20 or 30 seconds to spend on the next piece. That's a lot when you're doing, you know, just seven or eight minute pieces. So all this you have to take into consideration. And this is live on your feet in front of 20, 30, maybe 40 million people.
Did a good job with it.
Sometimes, not all the time.
Every program that I remember, you did a good job with.
I tried anyway.
I speak for a lot of people, too. Now, the Sid Caesar today, you're playing three different characters in Plaza Suite at the Drury Lane Theater, and it gives you a good chance to show off your versatility and your comedy timing. And you did something kind of close to this when you starred in Little Me.
There I only did eight.
Only eight characters.
That's all. I talk to myself coming in and going out.
I remember I brought up before the United Nations sketch where you played the four foreign dignitaries. Do you remember doing a skit about an international road race, and you portrayed an Italian, a French, an American, a Greek, and a Brazilian driver, plus you were a tire blowing out, the loudspeaker system, and the beautiful actress who ripped a vital seam in her dress as she bent over to kiss the winner?
Me? No, I think that was somebody.
It couldn't have been anybody but Sid Caesar.
No, I think that was Peter Ustinov.
Well, somebody remembers it, and we fondly remember those things. How long are you going to be here at the Drury Lane Theater?
Oh, we'll be here for six and a half more weeks.
Almost till about the 19th or so.
19th of September. September, yes.
Well, we wish you
good luck. And Miss Marion Walters, who's playing opposite with my co-star, who's she's doing a fantastic thing.
She's fantastic. Beautiful. She's marvelous.
Yes, she really does.
It's almost a two-man show.
Right. Two-person show.
It's a two-person. Well, I'm without putting down Marion Walters.
I don't know.
Sid Caesar, we're going to look for hopefully reruns of some of the shows.
Well, these have never been shown before. I mean, they've only been seen once. And if I think there's a very good chance of them coming through. My manager, Mr. Green, is in the throes of it. We're having calls back and forth from New York and California about the syndication, setting it up.
Where do you go from the Drury Lane?
We go right back to Hollywood. I do two shows there, and then I go into a syndication.
With this?
Yeah, and then I do other shows.
Well, we wish you good luck, and we thank you very much for this chance to chat about television and about Sid Caesar, and Those Were the Days.
I just want to say one thing. I mean, I may have sounded a little bitter or rough in the beginning about television, but what has happened is a terrible thing. They've taken a medium, which is, you know, like, it's like moving pictures, you know. It's a great art, and they've just torn it to pieces. There are no more studios, I mean, no big studios.
Mm-hmm.
And the networks are going only, it took Hollywood 50 years or 60 years to come to this point, almost 70 years, to where it just, you know, they just swallow themselves up. But television has telescoped that into a period of 20, 25, 23 years.
Very short time.
A very short time. Look what they've done. When they didn't learn any lesson from the movies. In fact, they're based, if they didn't have movies now, they couldn't be on. So they really didn't build anything. They didn't actually build. You understand what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm.
You see, when a studio in the old days, I'm not talking, not only, do you have time? Like in the movie, in movies, sure. When they built a star, they built a star. They had time. Mm-hmm. And when they...
What is it? Nothing. I'm just... I don't know how long you want to talk.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, please,
no,
go ahead.
The movies reinvested than themselves.
You see, what they did was, when they built the star made, all right, say he made $250 a week, $250 a week. But they built this star. And this star salary maybe we went up to $2,000-$3,000 a week. But this star, the whole studio was behind him. If this star went to London or a star went to Paris, there was public relations people from the studio. They protected their stars. They made them feel comfortable. They made them relaxed. They didn't have to worry about the economics of everything or where you're going to, who's going to get my room or who's going to. That was all taken care of so they could be stars. A television never had that. Television was strictly money from the beginning, but they didn't know how to make money out of it in the beginning. But when they learn, and they learn very fast, and as soon as lawyers and accountants get in, kiss it goodbye, because that's when the artist has to leave. Because when the accountants come in, artistry goes right out the window.
They take the creativity out of it.
Absolutely.
Well, I hope no one takes the creativity from you, Sid Caesar.
I hope so. Thank you. Thank you very much.